So we are looking today at Luke chapter 1. So if you have Bible or an app on your phone with the Bible on it, you guys can turn there to just get prepared. We're going to be looking at the story of Zechariah today and his path of peace, particularly his song at the end. I have to say this, I think I say it every single year, but the Sunday that we have the children's pageant is probably one of my favorite Sundays of the whole year, because it's just so delightful, and it's adorable, but I always think there's sort of profound moments in there too. You know, when the script just gets a little crazy, or, you know, there's a sheep wandering, and it brings a new perspective to the story. One of my favorite books as a kid was Barbara Robinson's The Best Christmas Pageant Ever. Have you guys ever read that or seen the film that was made, I think, like in the 80s? Yeah, a few hands. So it's about this family of kids that they're just kind of a mess. They're a disaster. It starts like this. The Herdmans were absolutely the worst kids in the history of the world. They lied and stole and smoked cigars, even the girls, and they talked dirty and hit little kids and cussed their teachers and took the name of the Lord in vain and set fire to Fred Shoemaker's old broken down tool house. So these are the kids in the story, and somehow they signed themselves up to be part of the local church's Christmas pageant. And it's just wild, as you can imagine. It's mayhem. And the book and the movie are absolutely hilarious. The thing that makes it so funny is that these kids they're not exactly who you'd expect to be in the sweet, nice church Christmas pageant. So Mary, you know, has like the socks that are mismatched, and the angel who's supposed to announce, you know, unto you, you know, a child is born to the shepherds, goes, hey, unto you a child is born. And then she starts whacking the shepherds to like get them to go to the stable. And it's just, it's not our image of what a sweet, nice church Christmas pageant should be. But the brilliance of the story, and you'll have to watch it to see how it all comes together, but is that it does all come together. And all of these bits that seem inconsistent with our idea of what it should have looked like actually make it the most profound and the best Christmas pageant that church has ever put on. Inconsistencies, these little things that just don't add up in our lives or in our own hearts, drive us nuts, especially if we see them in ourselves. And as we get older, as we become adults, we get better and better at hiding them or just living with them, you know, kind of making peace with the things that don't line up. But we don't get any less inconsistent, I don't think. A friend of mine just wrote this on Facebook. Am I clicking at the right thing? Oh, Rani, I might have to get you to be my clicker this week. So she just wrote this on Facebook. Trying to convince T, who is her daughter, that she can't have ice cream for breakfast is like trying to convince me I can write without chocolate. The only difference is I'm an adult and can make bad choices for myself. Which is true, and we do, right? Even though we know better. We all are full of these little inconsistencies in our lives. And then sometimes life, in a much more serious and a bigger sense, is just plain inconsistent on its own. Like many of you this week, I was watching the news in horror and reading these last messages from people in Aleppo who are on the front lines of the war right now in Syria. And just horrified and feeling helpless. And like so many other times in our lives, we're left asking, why is this happening? How could this be happening in this world? So no wonder we're stressed out. We've got these internal inconsistencies, which we're, you know, trying to downplay or, you know, live with. And then we have the bigger life inconsistencies as well. And trying to reconcile these things, or just trying to live with them well, is stressful. It takes a tremendous amount of energy. The story of Zechariah, I love, and I've been rediscovering it in the past couple weeks. It wrestles with these inconsistencies, both in our own hearts, but also in the world, in our bigger lives. And it resolves the issue, not with a nice, tidy answer at the end, but with the image of an old man, Zechariah, singing this song. A song about God's salvation and a song about finding the path to peace, being guided towards this path of peace. So I thought this morning, during what can be a chaotic time of year, classically Christmas, it would be good for us to sit at the feet of Zechariah, who is this wise old priest, and listen to his thoughts about what might guide us towards this path of peace. And so we'll just look at two aspects of that this morning. But before we get to the path of peace, let me introduce you to Zechariah. So just the first picture of him. He's like a statue. So I'm going to introduce you to Zechariah and tell you a little bit of the story of the most important day of his life. So here's Zechariah, and he looks a little pale in this picture, a little bit green. And he probably was a little bit green and pale on this day that was to be the most important day in his life. His heart was probably beating a million miles an hour. This was the morning he had been anticipating for his entire life as a priest in Israel. And it only happened to you once if you were a priest, and if you were lucky. And Zechariah was very old, so he just kind of slid in there. He'd spent his entire life serving in a synagogue, so he was like a local pastor of a small church. But in Israel, this was the local synagogue in a small town in the Judean hillside. And he and his wife, Elizabeth, led a very simple, humble life. They were deeply loved in their community. They were probably the ones you'd go to if you got in trouble and you needed a compassionate, maybe non-judgmental ear. I imagine there was always a runaway son or a fearful young bride sitting at their dinner table. Their life was not glamorous, but it had been faithful. The Bible introduces them as a faithful, righteous couple. But there was one thing that caused great sorrow and pain in their lives. Zechariah and Elizabeth had never been able to have children. And it was Zechariah's deep sorrow, the great injustice of his life. God was the one who gave children. In the Bible, as we read, it's very clear. It says God is the one who gives children to his people. And God was supposed to reward those who had been faithful to him. Yet Elizabeth and Zechariah remained childless despite their faithful, very good lives. The legacy of love and faithfulness of their family, because they were both from good families from way, way back, would die with them. It wouldn't get passed on to the next generation. So this was a terrible sorrow. And I think we see a little bit of that sadness in this statue. It was a terrible sorrow to carry in his heart. But what made it worse was the world, the context that he was living in. In Israel at that time, there was a lot of corruption and fear. They were living under a dictator, King Herod, who was oppressive and violent. And the young generation, this next generation that Zechariah saw growing up, was growing up with values that were very, very different from the ones that he had known, the ones that he understood to make Israel, Israel, faithfulness to God. Even their religious system was becoming corrupt and more about power and money and prestige than about serving the poor and welcoming the stranger. If only Zechariah had been able to bring a child into the world, even just one child, to keep the faith alive and glowing during these very dark days. This was his great sorrow. So how ironic that this was his symbolic task today. See, Zechariah had been chosen by lot, sort of like a lottery system, to enter the temple in Jerusalem before daybreak and light the incense. So the incense was supposed to be constantly burning before God, and this was a symbol of Israel's worship, that always throughout dark days, throughout light, there would be worship going up to God. And this was his job. It was the honor. You're only chosen once in your whole lifetime as a priest to go and do this. So he had been chosen to go at daybreak before the sun was even rising in the dark and light the incense. Now, this was a very special task, but it was also an extremely dangerous task. And it was dangerous because of where the altar of incense was. So when you entered into the temple, which only priests could do, you entered into sort of levels that got increasingly more holy and therefore a little bit more dangerous. And at the very center was the Holy of Holies, where God physically dwelt amongst his people. And the Holy of Holies
was so charged with God's holy presence that it would have been like standing next to an atomic bomb just ready to go off. So only the high priest entered the Holy of Holies. But the incense-lighting priest got to go right up to the curtain that separated the Holy of Holies from the rest of the temple. So it was a dicey place to be. A good place, a holy place, but also a bit of a scary place. But here, for the first time in his life, and it would be the last time in his life, Zechariah stood to light the incense before the sun rose in Israel that day. And I think he knew that this was his only chance. Bowing his head in the traditional way, Zechariah addressed God, who was right there. And he held nothing back. He prayed for a child for himself and Elizabeth, an honest, vulnerable prayer. And he prayed that a light would shine in the wounded generation that he saw growing up around him. And with a deep sigh, he opened his eyes, knowing that was it. He'd done all that he could. He had done a prayer to God right next to the Holy of Holies. And then suddenly, Ronnie, I'll get you to go to the next one, there was light. Now, this is imagined, as this artist has imagined it. We don't know actually what this looked like. But there was a sense of something as bright as the sun surrounding Zechariah. He was pretty sure he died. But a voice said, "Zechariah, do not be afraid. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son, and you are to call him John. He will be a joy and a delight to you. And many will rejoice because of his birth, for he will be great in the sight of the Lord. He will bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God." We'll go to the next slide. As the light shone around Zechariah, it revealed every line on his face and every thought hidden deep in his heart. And immediately, all of these little inconsistencies deep within him, his righteousness and faithfulness right alongside his bitterness, his faith right alongside his doubt, all of these things which he'd harbored kind of benignly for most of his life were on full display. And even in his fear, Zechariah knew that he was being rewarded. This angel was honoring him. Your prayer has been heard by God, and God is going to answer it with a son. But even as joy welled up, so did that old bitterness. But why has it taken this long? What about all of the other prayers? And so Zechariah found himself, probably shocking himself, in this special but dangerous place, suddenly saying to the angel Gabriel, "How can I be sure of this? I'm an old man, and my wife is well along in years," which I like. He didn't say she was old. She's well along in years. I imagine he was surprised to hear this coming out of his mouth at this moment, something he probably would never have said to anyone in all of his life. He was known, after all, for his steadfast faith. This was his reputation, blameless. Why choose this moment, of all the moments, to utter his secret doubt out loud? If he hadn't died yet, he would surely die now, because no one questions God. You're standing next to the unmediated presence of God in the temple, in the Holy of Holies, and comes out alive. That doesn't happen. So outside, the people are waiting, and his fellow priests are starting to get anxious because he'd been inside for too long to just light the incense and then get out. Had something happened to him? Inside, God's spokesperson, who is displayed here as the angel of Gabriel, he looks at Zechariah after this cheeky response that Zechariah has done, and he says, "I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. I'm a big deal. And I have been sent to you to tell you this good news. And now you are going to be silent and not able to speak until the day that this happens, because you did not believe my words, which will come true at the appointed time." it was a different Zechariah that stumbled out of the temple that morning. It was as though, I imagine, all the threads of his life, all these inconsistencies, these questions, alongside his faith and his hope, were finally starting to weave together. He couldn't hear or speak until his son was born, but for the first time in his life, I imagine a deep peace settled in his bones. We can go to the next slide. When was the last time you felt a deep peace just settle in your bones? Let's take a moment. I've been thinking about this question all week. I can't quite pinpoint a time, but I know that there have been. Perhaps it was a moment when everything just kind of clicked. You know, maybe in ordinary life, you're watching your kids, and you just thought, yes, the choices I've made have been worth it. Yep. And you just feel that peace. And those moments are beautiful. We hang on to them, right? Because for every moment like that, there's probably 10,000 moments we don't feel like that. We're wondering, have we done the right thing? Are we doing the right thing? Are we on the right path? There are all of these inconsistencies in our lives. And so today I'm going to talk about two, in sort of two categories based on Zechariah's story. And first are these outer inconsistencies. And for those, Zechariah's story teaches us to lean into God's timeline. There are so many things in our lives that haven't worked out the way we expected they would. It's part of, I think, growing old and wise is learning to make peace with these things. This is not exactly how I pictured it going, but here we are. It might be your job. It might be your marriage or your kids or your health. And I think we do come to a place where we say, okay, we can make peace with this. But it's easier said than done. And some things in our lives just don't make sense, I think. Some pain just doesn't fit into a category, doesn't have a nice answer that goes along with it. Especially when it comes to good people or innocent people suffering. Zechariah and his wife Elizabeth were good people who couldn't have kids. And we know from either personal experience or experience of friends how deeply painful that is. But they were also good people who lived in a time and a context where evil seemed to flourish, where bad things were happening, and it seemed like more bad things were happening than good things. For Zechariah, well, after Zechariah's encounter with God in the temple, and after it all came true, because it did, he had a son, and his son went on to prepare the way for Israel, for Israel's Messiah, for Jesus to come and bring peace. But after it all came true and he got his voice back, the first words out of Zechariah's mouth are a song. It was a song about finding the path of peace and about God's salvation. And so if you have your sermon insert in your bulletin, you'll find the song printed out and you can read along and see it. For Zechariah, if you read the song, you'll notice lots of language about overcoming enemies, salvation, being redeemed. You'll also notice language about worshiping God, about prayer, about being set free to worship God. For Zechariah, peace and the path of peace encompassed, and we can go to, I think it's the next, yes, encompassed the social, political, and spiritual realities of life. In other words, it was a really big picture of peace that he sang about. It meant being saved from very real enemies in the world, and it also meant being sent free to worship God and be forgiven of his sins. So this is a really big, scary big picture of peace that Zechariah sings after this encounter with God in the temple as an old man. I think sometimes in church we try and make this picture a little bit more manageable for ourselves. And we talk about peace in terms of a spiritual reality or an emotion. So this idea that God wants to give us a feeling of peace in our hearts. And that's part of our experience for sure as Christians and as those who have joined Christ into the life of Christ. But that's only part of it. And when the Bible talks about peace, it uses this word shalom, which is huge. And it means life and flourishing. It means things that were broken being reconciled and healed. It means peace happening in the Middle East. And remember, that's where this story takes place, is in the Middle East. So no wonder Zechariah questioned the angel when he said, your son is going to start to make way for this peace. I think most of us, when presented with this huge image of what peace encompasses, it's like hard to get inside our brains. It's hard to picture what that would actually look like. And we'd probably question the angel too. Could this Savior of Israel, this little baby that will be born in a manger, really bring about peace in this world? Zechariah, in his song, demonstrates that he believes in time this baby would bring about peace. Timing is key in the story. Luke, who's the author of this, this particular version of Jesus' birth, Christmas story, makes all of these cues that refer to time throughout the story. He lets us know exactly how long Elizabeth has been pregnant when Mary comes to visit her. He tells us who is ruling, who the political leader is, and he makes all of these references to the specific, very real time. After Zechariah's cheeky questioning of the angel, the angel responds and says, what I've said is going to come true in the appointed time, at the right time. And you are going to be silent for that period of time, which is hard to be silent for that long. He takes his voice away. Timing is key. This baby was going to be born, Zechariah's child was going to be born, not on his timeline, but on God's timeline. And we find out as we read through the story that Zechariah's wife's cousin, Mary, who's probably about 14 in the story, eventually gets pregnant with this baby who's going to be Jesus, who's going to save the world and bring peace. And John, who will be Zechariah's baby, needed to be born at the same time because their destinies were working together. John was the one who was just a little bit older. He was going to prepare the way and say, hey, here's Jesus. So Zechariah waited his whole life for Jesus to be born, or for his son to be born, at the same time that this 14-year-old girl who had just started life was going to have a baby. Their babies would grow up together. God's timing in this story is perfect, but it sure wasn't on Zechariah's timeline. I don't know when we're going to see widespread peace on earth. That still just seems like something that the girls say in Miss America pageants, you know, peace on earth. But I do believe, and this is the Christian hope, that one day we will. And it's crazy, but that is what we believe. We believe that it will happen on God's timeline. How do we, before I get into that, let's look at what Paul writes in Colossians chapter 1. And if you have your Bible or your phone, you can flip to it. I'm reading out of the Message version because I just think it's beautiful and brilliant how Eugene Peterson translates it. He says, so spacious is Jesus, so roomy, that everything of God finds its proper place in him without crowding. Not only that, but all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people and things, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross. Another way of saying that might be that in Jesus, because of his life, because of his death on the cross, we can have hope that all of these inconsistent things in the bigger scheme, in the bigger world, will one day somehow be woven into the story. There will be reconciliation in this earth. And that's the hope that we cling to. So how do we do that when God's timeline is not ours? It's hard. And I think probably all of us have been in that place of needing an answer or waiting for a thing or having a deep unfulfilled longing and just wondering, why God, not now? Allie made these beautiful ornaments, I guess it was a couple weeks ago. And it's interesting, as as evangelicals, we don't usually carry around crucifixes. We don't have, you know, a cross hanging down with, you know, Jesus on it. But I have found this little ornament, this representation of a cross, extremely helpful to me this week. As I watched the news and tried to reconcile, how is this happening in your world, God, the world that you love? The cross is a symbol, was a symbol, and still is today, of torture and death. And at the same time, it is at the heart of our faith as a symbol of life, because Christ went to the cross, to this dark, horrible place that is real on earth, and in his death, he planted a seed of life that will grow, that is growing, even in the darkest places of our world right now, and is bringing healing and hope, and will one day finally completely cover this earth in peace. So Allie's cross is made out of two, what are they called, nails. You can tell that I'm great at home improvement stuff. Two nails, what are these sharp, pointy things? And it's covered in these beautiful, shiny beads. And I have just, as I've been praying, I've been holding on to it this week as a symbol of hope, as a way of leaning into something that I don't understand fully, but that I know something had to do, this cross has to do something with my ability to just wait, to hold on until all is made well. So perhaps for you, you need something tangible like this to hold on to. For others, it's in moments like when we celebrate communion as a church, or just reflecting on your own, on what Christ's death means for us. It's a personal thing, but it also means great hope for this world. There will be peace, there will be reconciliation and redemption. And this is our hope, and the hope that gives us peace as we celebrate the birth of Christ, the one who brings healing into our world. But there's another aspect of these inconsistencies in life. They're not just out there in the world, they're also very real inside our hearts. And I think we can go to the next slide, Rainey. Yes. Learning to pray with honesty. I think this is another facet that Zechariah teaches us through his story and also through his song. There's so many things in our hearts that don't add up. No matter how good we are or how good we're perceived to be by others, like Zechariah, we all have hidden fears, hidden doubts, or little knots of bitterness that we just can't seem to quite get rid of, things we can't bring ourselves to forgive, or the things that we run to just take the edge off of our discomfort. And harboring these things inside ourselves takes a lot of energy. And while we might not consciously think about it every day, these are things that cause us stress. They're barriers to peace. I couldn't help but wonder, as I reflected on this story this week, what would have been exposed if I were standing under Gabriel's gaze in the holy, or next to the Holy of Holies? But the truth is, most of us don't need an angelic light. We already know, because we know what these inconsistencies are in our lives quite often. If you live in a family, if you're in a relationship of just about any kind, of even just moderate intimacy, these things tend to bring up these little inconsistencies in our own heart, our actions and our words lining up or not lining up. In the Old Testament, God's salvation is spoken of as this light often, something that shines into darkness and it brings with it warmth and growth and healing. It's a beautiful picture, but it's also a scary picture, because when light shines on things, it exposes everything. And that doesn't sound peaceful to us. Most of us would like to run in the opposite direction of having the light expose all the stuff that we're trying to kind of, you know, keep under control. My Auntie Paula told this wonderful story that I love about an elderly woman that she met. Those of you who have ever worked in or cared for someone who is in a retirement home has experienced that as people get older, often lose their inhibitions, things that they have been keeping deep down in their hearts for long come up and come out. And that can be distressing. It is really distressing. And it can be a little bit scary as we think about getting older. So my Auntie Paula was thinking about this, and she met this very sweet, sweet, kind elderly woman. And she said, you know, in her southern accent, how do you get to be just such a sweet old lady? And as you can only say in a southern accent. And she, this dear lady looked up at her, and she said, well, honey, you have to start by being a sweet young lady. And it's true, right? We have to start now. And how do we become sweet young ladies or gentlemen? How do we do that? We allow the light to shine on us so that it can warm us with Christ's love and also so that it can get rid of the gunk. For Zechariah, that meant being honest with God in his prayer. And I don't know how conscious his response was, if he was like, I'm going to ask this angel what he really means, or if it was more just, bah, I just said that out loud. I don't know. But it came out of his heart. And I don't think that was a bad thing. We have two accounts in the Christmas story of angels coming to people. Well, two accounts. We have a number, but we often compare, I think, Zechariah's story with Mary's. So in Mary's story, the angel comes to her. She's sweet. Maybe like 14, 15-year-old girl, and he tells her this incredible news, you're going to have a baby. And she responds with this beautiful, humble, all right, God, I don't get it, but let it be to me as you have said. And it was the right response. It was a beautiful response. But I think sometimes we give Zechariah a bad rap for being like, no, what? How can I be sure that this is going to happen? Zechariah was not 14 years old. Zechariah was in the winter of his life. And he had seen a lot. He'd experienced a lot. And perhaps had a lot more experience weighing in as this angel came to him. I think that it came out of a place of mature faith. A faith that knew he could question God next to the Holy of Holies and somehow come out alive. Because that's the kind of faith that believes in the mercy of God. No, he wasn't unchastised. There were consequences to the bitterness that was exposed. But somehow, Zechariah, I think he knew that he could lean into God's mercy, even in his sin. And that's precisely the good news that Jesus embodies. It's one of the things we celebrate with the birth of Christ, was the birth of the one who would show us incredible grace, that us, who have all of these inconsistencies in us, can come before the holy God without fear, and know that he's going to treat us with mercy, and he's going to give us a way, through maybe some pruning, as Zechariah experienced, to come into his presence, to come into life, and to clear out some of the gunk that is in our heart. I think we can do this as well. And one of the ways, there are many, but one of the ways is by learning to pray honestly. I think, again, I don't know where it happens in Sunday school, but at some point, I think we learn that we need to pray these really nice prayers to God, that it should sound nice somehow. But if you read the Old Testament's prayer book, the Psalms, you quickly discover that prayer doesn't have to be nice all the time. It can be honest before God, and it should be honest. For those of us who have grown up just trying to pray nice prayers, it can take a little bit of unlearning to figure out how do we just come before God as we are, knowing that he accepts us in his mercy. And I think one of the ways we do that is by using the Psalms, so reading them and saying, how are these people expressing their honest, authentic selves with their doubts and their sin and their fear before God. Another way is through different prayer exercises. So I have a spiritual director who I meet with once a month, and she's kind of like my pastor in some ways, and she helps me hear God's voice, and she leads me through scripture. And she always begins with a time of prayer that helps me be honest before God. And one of my favorites, which I now do on my own, I don't know if this is the technical term for it, but I call it the elevator prayer. And what you do is you imagine that there's kind of like an elevator in you that starts up here and goes down. And you kind of get on that internal elevator, and you just go down slowly, and you just pay attention to how you're feeling. So it's just a simple sort of method of saying, God, I'm really stressed out today, and I feel a little yucky, and I feel joyful here. And you just kind of take a little bit of a check. You do the elevator ride down through. You say, this is who I am right now, this afternoon. And you bring all of that stuff, and you bring it before God in honesty. I found that extremely helpful. As we learn to pray honestly before God, I believe we learn to let his light shine in on parts of our hearts that perhaps we have closed off because we didn't think they were nice enough to bring before him. And we allow his healing to come into our lives. So the peace that Christ offers us through himself, I don't think that it guarantees everything in our lives. All of these inconsistent threads are going to fully make sense by the time we die. And that we're going to be perfectly sweet little old ladies and men. But I think that it offers us hope that all of these parts are still accepted in God's presence. And that he is working with them, whether we get it or not, he is working with all of them. And he will bring reconciliation one day in his timing. And so this Christmas, here is my charge to all of us. As we think about peace and what this means in the midst of stress and, well, things that don't make sense. This Christmas, let's bring all of ourselves before God. All the deep, unfulfilled longing, let's be honest about it. The questions, the doubts and the fears and maybe the messy emotions, the pent-up rage, bring it along with your hope. Along with your faith, along with your joy, and accept the peace deep in your bones that comes from knowing that in time, all of this will be reconciled, held together in Christ. I invite the worship team to come up. They're going to play a song for us. And maybe during this song, you want to do the elevator and just be like, what? How am I this morning, and what am I bringing to God? And maybe it will be just be a time of praying. Perhaps it will be a time of clinging to the cross and just saying, Lord, have mercy. I don't understand, but Lord, have mercy. I believe that this has some hope for me. And then afterwards, we're going to have a time for comments, for reflections, questions I can't promise to answer, and thoughts. So if you want, you can jot those down as well. So let's pray and worship.